Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, perhaps any verdict in the Darun Ravi Rutgers case would have left many people stunned and confused. What is the role of the criminal justice system when one college freshman uses a webcam to spy on his gay roommate having sex, uses Twitter to invite others to watch, and the roommate commits suicide after he finds out? Is it just boorish horseplay? Is it a hate crime? Should it matter legally that the victim killed himself? Should Darun Ravi go to prison at all, or, as an immigrant, be deported? After a weekend to think about it, we will take your reactions to the verdict and potential sentences to begin this week and any other lessons from this case at 212-433-WNYC or online at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show from the Rutgers community or anywhere else, 212-433-9692. With us first, as your calls are coming in, WNYC's Arun Venugopal, who's been covering the campus reaction this weekend. Hi, Arun. It's spring break at Rutgers, isn't it?
Yeah, so they were just returning yesterday, actually, Brian.
And I know people at Rutgers. My sense is that many students have complicated feelings about this. Like, I could be the victim of this kind of hate or high-tech humiliation, regardless of my background or sexual orientation. So everyone's at risk, and something has to be done. But at the same time, not much hunger to see Ravi imprisoned or deported.
I think a lot of people, say a majority of the people, the students I spoke to, they felt that the conviction was warranted, but they had more complicated feelings when it came to the sentencing. Like, does he really need to go to jail at all? And does he need to go to jail that long, depending on the sentencing guidelines?
So here's a little of the range of what you've brought back. Here is student Jason Rivera on the more lenient side of what you've been hearing.
I believe he suffered the consequences enough. He got a lot of bad publicity, and everybody seemed to hate him for a while. I think he shouldn't have to do any time, but maybe community service at the most.
And here is student Vidya Raghavan on the tougher side.
Yeah, I was thinking it's kind of good only because it sets an example for the future generations that you cannot get away with such a crime. So I think somebody has to take this bold step of giving such a severe punishment.
So that's kind of the combination or the range of things you've been hearing?
Definitely. You know, people like her who felt that it was just absolutely outrageous what he did, and there should be no tolerance for that kind of behavior, that he very well knew what he was doing, and that there were true consequences to what he did. And then you have others who felt it was more of a childish prank, and that it was, I guess, the kind of thing that just blew up in a way that he could not have foreseen the consequences that Tyler Clementi would have committed suicide.
How much, if at all, is this becoming a clash of identity groups? LGBT students on one side and South Asians or even immigrants in general more defensive of Ravi?
Well, I think it is. It actually is kind of a mix. Yeah. For instance, Vidya Raghavan herself is a student from India. I've spoken to South Asian.
The student there who was talking
who
in
just,
tough
who
terms.
Just, that's right. Who thought that definitely his conviction would set an example for the campus and for the broader community. But of course, I have also spoken to South Asian gay activists who are not on campus, but who have been watching this and who feel that there should be a more lenient, I guess, stance taken towards him.
Let's take a call. Paul in Bergen County. You're on WNYC. Paul, thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to comment on the anti-bullying and anti-harassment legislation that became law last fall and how it's positively impacted my child.
Is that a New Jersey state law?
New Jersey state law, yeah. 2 years ago, he was assaulted three times, three separate incidents, three separate students. And despite hiring an attorney, we had to deal with frustration and all. This year, he had an incident last month, relatively minor, but it was still something that was considered bullying and intimidation.
So now, Paul, we have a very bad phone line, but are you saying that the Ravi Tyler Clementi case led to legislation which is helping your son?
Correct.
Thank you very much. And Arun Venugopal, I don't know if you want to say anything before you go about kind of the larger impact in the community. Paul seems to be an example of the larger conversation that this case has unleashed in our society and one piece of legislation that's come as a result of it.
Well, I didn't encounter students yesterday who spoke that directly to that in terms of in a personal sense, but you definitely had this, I guess, this divide, people who felt that You know, college is a place where some of them might be younger, committing immature acts in an innocent way, and others felt that they're adults and really should face real-world consequences for these things.
WNYC's Arun Venugopal, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Joining us now is Nancy Solomon, managing editor of New Jersey Public Radio, who covered the trial in the courtroom. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Brian.
And can you explain the verdict a little bit? Because there were many counts, and I think many listeners are still confused.
Right. So there were 15 counts, and he was convicted on all of them. And so what that covers is invasion of privacy, attempted invasion of privacy, hindering a prosecution, tampering with evidence, witness tampering, and then the most serious of them all was the hate crime, bias intimidation. What there was a digital smoking gun. There was a series of tweets, texts, instant message chats, emails that laid out this whole story. So there really was, beyond a reasonable doubt, evidence on the invasion of privacy. There was the videotape where he basically got caught lying to the police on the video. There was the text that he sent to Molly Way, the co-defendant, saying, "Did you tell them we did it on purpose?" And the tweets inviting people to come and use his webcam. So there was this digital track, and I think the one big question was the bias intimidation.
And that's the one that everybody was saying could pull 10 years in prison.
Exactly. That was the most serious charge. It's an add-on sentence to the invasion of privacy. They had to find that he was guilty of invasion of privacy, and then they add on the sentence. And, you know, the fact is, the prosecution showed that he humiliated Tyler Clementi. I think there was some reasonable doubt about whether he intimidated him, and that's how the law reads. So it'll be really interesting to see what the judge does with the sentencing.
John in Smithtown, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling, John.
Hi, Brian. How are you doing? Thank you. I think Darun Ravi is a bully. I think he's a pervert and a peeping Tom, but I don't know if that's deserving of 10 years in prison. I think the real tragedy here is that there was a young man who was very uncomfortable with his sexuality, and someone who wrongfully and disgustingly, you know, outed him, led to his suicide. I don't think Darun Ravi is responsible for Mr. Clementi's suicide. I think he's responsible for being a peeping Tom.
John, thank you for your call. So, Nancy, how explicitly did this come up in the trial? Would the charges, in theory, have been the same if the roommate had not committed suicide? Would the charges, in real life, do you think, have been the same had Tyler Clementi not have taken his own life?
The prosecutors talked about this right after the verdict, and basically they said they kind of intimated that they might not have gone so aggressively after Ravi had Clementi not killed himself, but that going forward in the future, they felt that from now on, with the facts of this case in terms of using a webcam, invasion of privacy, harassment of someone because they're gay, that they wouldn't wait for a suicide to prosecute, that they would. That's that point. I think it's interesting that there's so many people out there who've been following this who think so poorly of Darun Ravi. I think that's a major failure of his defense attorneys. They had an opportunity to put character witnesses on the stand during their defense, and they did a really bad job of it. I mean, they just did not – they were not able to create a picture of this kid that was sympathetic at all.
So you think that there was a context here that they didn't bring into the trial. Talk about that.
Yeah. So what we heard from was a whole group of students who had just moved into the dorm. This is the third week of September. They're all freshmen, and there's sort of a jockeying going on about who's going to be friends with whom and popularity. And I think that, you know, if you read between the lines when you listen to all of the testimony, you get this picture of Darun Ravi now has some social currency. He has some gossip that is salacious, and everybody wants to know about it. So everyone wants to talk to him. He's at the center of this gossip, and it's fueling him. It's encouraging him. I mean, we're talking about 3 days here that this happens, mm-hmm. and two different incidents. And they're encouraging him. He's texting a ton. He's chatting. And everybody wants to know what's going on with his roommate. Who's that older man in the room? They want to, you know, see it on the webcam. And so I think, you know, here's an individual who's going to go to prison for this, but he was part of a larger situation in which there was homophobia and there was a reckless lack of any concern about Tyler Clementi and how they were endangering his psyche.
And none of his friends, none of the people in his circle who he was sharing this with via Twitter said, hey, come on, stop.
Yeah, there was not one piece of evidence where the, and this whole thing was laid out in text and Twitters. It was all a written record. Not one kid tweets back, texts back, says anything like, hey, man, this isn't cool. Leave the kid alone.
But is that a defense?
That would have been a defense. Well, it would have been a defense. It wouldn't have been a defense for Ravi. That's why it doesn't come out. The defense, mm-hmm. the defense attorney doesn't have any interest in bringing that out, and the prosecution doesn't. But I think if the prosecution would have brought it out, because it would have showed that he didn't listen to that person. And it, so, yeah.
We're talking about the Darun Ravi verdict with Nancy Solomon, managing editor of New Jersey Public Radio. Your calls, our lines are full. We'll keep taking your calls. And also with us now is Emily Bazelon, who writes about legal affairs for Slate. Hi, Emily. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian.
First of all, you have no doubt, I see from your writing, that Ravi didn't just behave badly, he broke the law. So put it as simply as you can for the non-lawyers in the crowd and the non-convinced.
I think Nancy's right that there was just incontrovertible evidence about the invasion of privacy charge. And when you look at the statute and then you look at the spying that Ravi did, he broke the law on that count. And I think, you know, particularly hard to stomach was the way in which he planned the second spying attempt. And it really seems from all the electronic records like he was kind of showing off to his friends in a way that's, you know, it's kind of reprehensible.
And yet you wrote after the – or consistent with that, you wrote that after the verdict, Ravi will surely go to prison. Why do you think so? This seems to be such a matter of debate in the public's mind.
You know, I hope it's a matter of debate, but I think it's going to be hard for this judge not to send Ravi to prison given the 10-year sentence he faces. That's a big penalty. And so to go all the way down to probation or community service would be a big, I think, political risk for that judge. I hope he's willing to think about it, because I think that prison time for a crime like this is too much, as one of your callers said earlier.
Nancy, you brought one clip of tape of something that you thought was a very key moment in the trial, which you were allowed to record under New Jersey law. You can't do that in New York.
Set it up for us. So this was first, it was the last piece of evidence that the prosecutor entered in her case. And it was the next to the last, but it was a huge bang. So it was a 52-minute interview with Darun Ravi by investigators. And over the course of that 52 minutes, they catch him in a couple of lies, and they have this exchange where they basically corner him about the invasion of privacy.
I dare you to video chat me between the hours of 9:30 and 12. Yes, it's happening again.
But obviously, I said that in a sarcastic way, first of all, and second of all, I turned off my computer so they wouldn't be able to. I put it to sleep so they wouldn't be able to do anything.
So he says, you know, I was kidding, and I'm really the one who turned off the computer. It turns out he's not the one who turned off the computer, and that was one of the many ways he tried to defend himself that fell flat. But the fact is that he really, why didn't the defense attorney put someone on the stand that said, this kid was constantly joking around, this kid was sarcastic, and half of what he said was never true, and the other half, he meant the opposite as a joke. You never heard that.
Emily, do you think that this verdict expands the definition of hate crimes or redefines hate crimes for the digital era?
Well, the New Jersey hate crime statute is really broad. I mean, basically, there's a whole range of underlying offenses, and they don't have to be violent. And if you commit one of them, an invasion of privacy is an example, and then the jury finds that on top of that, you acted with bias for the purpose of targeting a particular group, then you're guilty of this hate crime. So the statute has been there, but and it dates from 1990 in its current form. But what's new is applying it in a situation like this. And I think the digital record in this case is hugely important. I mean, as Nancy said, you could see everything Ravi was doing and thinking and texting with his friends. It's all there in this very indelible, stark way. If there were just witnesses and a kind of he said, she said accounting of this, I don't think we would have seen this case go the way that it did.
Jean in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jean.
Hi. Thank you, Brian, for taking my call. Sure. Yeah, I felt all through the trial very ambivalent, not about the heinousness of the act that had been committed, but about what was it being handled properly, and was this hate crime charge maybe over too over the top of whatever. But anyway, I had very great concern about the trial. But I also, at the same time, lean toward the feeling that this was really a terrible thing that this young man did, and he's got to be held to serious account for it. Where I came down after the verdict was to think, wait a minute, couldn't there have been an internal process within the university that would have involved students, would have involved a very serious response to what had taken place? And wouldn't that have been more appropriate?
I think that's a great question, Jean. And, Emily, it's something that comes up on college campuses all across the country for all kinds of things, underage drinking violations, all kinds of things. Where is the line between something that a college campus itself should deal with or something that outside law enforcement should deal with?
Well, you're absolutely right, and it is such a good point to bring up. You know, what happened here was that Tyler Clemente complained to his advisor. He asked for a room change, and then he committed suicide. And so that very tragic event, understandably, involved the police. Once the police were involved, it's sort of outside of Rutgers' hands. That there's no longer a possibility that the university disciplinary process is going to be used to deal with this case. And I think you're right. It would have been much better and probably more proportional if Rutgers had been able to mete out the punishment. But you can also understand, once the police are involved and the prosecutors see what happened here, why they felt it was necessary to bring these invasion of privacy charges.
Mary in Rutgers Land, New Brunswick. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. I am very upset with this whole thing. My son just graduated from Rutgers University, and I am just flabbergasted. This young man could have done what he did very stupidly and caused somebody to commit suicide. Now, this family is at a loss for their child, and this kid just thought it was so funny, and it wasn't funny at all. I don't know what he thought was funny. Is he a homophobic? I don't understand why this happened at all.
But what do you think what do you think the sentence should be?
I think it's what they said. I think he should go to jail. This
really?
Is something he has to be made accountable. Absolutely.
Thank you very much. And let's go to Giovanni in Bed-Stuy. You're on WNYC. Giovanni, hello.
Good morning. I mean, the question I have about this is a question that this person was involved in something that was reprehensible. But I kind of question the motive of the jury. I mean, historically, this man's an immigrant. He's a minority. He's from India. And I think historically you see the actions that were taken against him and the opinions that are held about minorities. And what about the jury? Was the jury guilty of discrimination, maybe a hate crime, because this man was not, white or an American?
Giovanni, thank you for raising that issue. Nancy, how did they deal with it in jury selection or at any other point?
Well, there were some South Asian potential jurors who were released, and you got to kind of wonder about that. But the fact is the jury was very diverse. There were African Americans on the jury. There weren't any South Asians. But a couple jurors spoke after the verdict on Friday and said that they knew this, that this young man's life was in their hands, and they took it very seriously, and they felt that the evidence showed that he was guilty of the crimes. That's what they were asked to do. And in what was I was so surprised at how quickly they came to the verdict. And I think, and what one of the jurors said was, is that there wasn't a whole lot of disagreement in the room. They looked through all the digital evidence, and they all agreed.
Now, why is deportation on the table as a possible sentence? Is it the judge in this case who, when they do the sentencing hearing in May, might or might not come down with deportation, or is that a separate process?
It's a completely separate process. It involves the ICE, the immigration, or whatever that stands for, the Federal Immigration Agency. And so the prosecutor reports to the federal government that there is a felony conviction, and then it's up to federal immigration officials to decide whether to proceed. And it would happen only after he's served his sentence.
April in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, April.
Hi. I agree that I think his ethnicity had something to do with it. And, you know, I'm really of two minds. I sort of think that the judgment was excessive. But what I would like to know is what happened to all the many cases of kids online ganging up on a person who commits suicide, urging them to commit suicide. I mean, that seems to me much more serious.
It's another great question. And Emily Bazelon, you're writing a book on bullying called Sticks and Stones. And I wonder how you see this case in the context of that and with a direct answer to April's question.
I think we have a lot of fear right now about the intersection between bullying and the internet and suicide. And then there are a couple of questions. Is bullying really the cause of suicide in this kind of simple way that some very sensationalized cases have claimed? I think when you talk to suicide experts, they will tell you that it's almost always more complicated than that, that, you know, depression and other kinds of mental illness and family history factor into this decision. But it's a very understandable fear, and you're right that there's a lot of loose talk on some social media sites where kids kind of ask each other about committing suicide or say, oh, so-and-so should commit suicide, and it's truly alarming. It just seems like a kind of discourse that can do no good in the world.
Well, this conversation obviously goes on. We've had a few pieces of it today. We appreciate the many calls and comments on our webpage that have come in. You can keep having the conversation at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We thank Emily Bazelon, senior editor and court watcher at Slate, whose new book, Sticks and Stones, about bullying is in the works. And we thank Nancy Solomon, managing editor of New Jersey Public Radio, who was in the courtroom in our studio today. Thank you both.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we go to Washington and talk to The Takeaway's Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick, who finds that, lo and behold, in this year that is supposed to be the do-nothingest of do-nothing Congresses, stuff is getting done. Stay with us.